Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the disconnect between an unpopular president and his popular policies. Joe Biden's presidency began with the country in turmoil and with political rancor gripping Washington. But a majority of Americans approved of him. Biden's popularity remained constant through his first 100 days. He enacted a stimulus plan and introduced an agenda that included infrastructure spending and support for social programs like universal pre-K and paid family leave, all of which polled well with voters. But now, all that has changed. Today, a majority of Americans disapprove of the job that president is doing. On Thursday morning, I spoke with Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report, a nonpartisan newsletter that analyzes political trends. I asked her what's behind Biden's numbers and what this could mean for Democrats as we head toward the midterm elections. Amy, we keep hearing about Joe Biden's tanking numbers. What are they now? How bad are they?
Well, Diane, if you look at, which I do, the average of the president's approval ratings, and I go to places like 538.com and Real Clear Politics because they take all of the national polling, they aggregate it. The president's somewhere around 42 or 43% job approval rating, which, as you said, how do we put that in context? What does that mean? If we compare it to Donald Trump, at this point in Trump's presidency, it's a little bit better than where he was. He was somewhere in the high 30s, low 40s. But if we compare it to other presidents, Clinton, Obama, you can't really do Bush at this point because we were in the immediate wake of 9/11. But if you compare to those other presidents, going all the way back, I think, to Eisenhower, he is at a lower point than any of them this early in his presidency. And so that's just, right, it's not a good sign. If you're thinking about the upcoming midterm elections, the other thing that this president has in common with, say, the previous two presidents, as they were going into their first midterm elections, you can see he has low approval ratings among independent voters, which explains a lot of the drop in his overall approval rating. And the intensity gap is also pretty strong. So that means people who really strongly disapprove of Biden, that they are bigger percent than the people who say they strongly approve.
So how do you account for this? He came in at a time when there was great turmoil in the country. The former president contested the election. President Biden said he was going to try to bring the country back to normal. Well, normal is always in the eyes of the beholder. So the question becomes, given the virus, given the economy's reaction to the virus, how is it that Joe Biden's numbers reflect such animosity against him?
Against him personally.
Yeah. He could rule the world and make it all go away.
You know, in fact, there was a poll out today by this group called Navigator. They're a Democratic firm, but they've been very upfront and honest about when they get bad numbers about the president or about Democratic policies. And what they found was what you pointed out, which is, you know, when you ask voters point blank, okay, this economy and all the problems we're having, supply chains and inflation, how much of this is what the president's doing and his policies? And how much of this is we're coming out of a pandemic, for crying out loud? So a slight majority, about 52%, say it's all that other stuff. It's not the president, right? His policies aren't necessarily responsible for all the things that we're seeing, the challenges in the economy. At the same time, Diane, you know that people have to blame something, right? It's not, okay, you maybe it's not your fault, but we kind of expect you to try to fix it. And I think that is the frustration. More than that, when you see the enthusiasm gap, and this is not unique to Biden, but when you are the president and the party that's out of power feels helpless, especially when the person in the White House also controls the House and the Senate, that frustration level just grows and grows and grows, right? Because not only did you lose the presidential election, you have very few levers now to stop the president and his policies. And every time he does something that you don't like, it just reminds you, oh, God, I can't believe this guy's president. I knew this was going to, I knew he was going to do this. I knew this president was going to do Y. We saw it with Trump, right? The intense dislike of Trump among Democrats. So much of it, of course, was about how he conducted himself, who he was. But a lot of it, too, was our greatest fears are coming true, say Democrats, because this guy was elected. We told you he was going to do these terrible things. So that kind of comes with the territory. The challenge for Democrats in a midterm election, though, is that it is simply a referendum on the president. Come 2024, then it's a choice. It's to your point, Diane, which is, okay, you say I'm not doing a great job on this. What are you going to do? What are your answers? How are you going to fix this? I've done X, Y, and Z. And voters, you get to decide which one of us do you think will do a better job? Me, I can show you this I've done, this guy or this woman who says she's going to do this. But you can't do that in a midterm election because it's really just a report card on the current administration.
So maybe your prognostication, considering where the president is today and that the 22 elections are around the corner, you think he is going to be at the center of whether people vote for Republicans or Democrats. But, Amy, what about redistricting? Yeah. My goodness, what's happened there is that you've got so many districts already locked in. And of course, the president will be blamed once again. I mean, you would hope that eventually the American voter would come to realize how these things are both separate and glued together.
Yes, right. The more we are polarized by, you're right, one, congressional districts drawn certain ways, a media environment, that it doesn't just continue this polarization. It revels in it. It continues to sow that dislike and distrust and chaos and anger. So you have those two factors at work on top of a society that is still recovering from a once-in-a-lifetime event. And Diane, that's where I think we really don't spend enough time appreciating the long tail of this pandemic. We are dealing with the immediate day-to-day in our lives, how much things cost, how much inflation has impacted that, right? So that's the immediate day-to-day. And the continued worries. Should I be worried now about Omicron? Should I get my five-year-old vaccinated, right? All of these worries are still out there. But we are still dealing with what it meant to shut down our society for a year, what it meant to our mental health, our physical health. I don't think it's a coincidence we had a record number of overdose deaths in this last year, that we are hearing, and I'm hearing a lot of this as a parent of a high schooler, of so many mental health challenges for our kids coming back into school. So there's just this persistent, it just feels like we're in a really muddled place. And that too is impacting some of its perceptions of the president, but just this overall mood it's a pessimistic mood. Where the president...
A pessimistic mood,
yeah,
that continues now, as you said, with the Omicron,
yeah,
virus, mm-hmm, now coming through. And by the way, you and I have both pronounced that as the New York Times has given us that A-H at the beginning rather than the O at the beginning. So we'll let it go at that. But with his new virus coming in, what more can the president do? And here's where I come back to your earlier point about the media and what the media is conveying to people about what it is the president's numbers really mean. Do they mean he's doing a lousy job, or do they mean this is all he can do?
Right.
And we need to understand that.
Right.
The media is not saying it that way.
Yeah. It also depends on what your definition of the media is. And more people are getting their news from YouTube or Facebook or what has been forwarded to them through some app, right? So it's harder and harder now to put our arms around what the media is actually doing. All that said, I think what happened over the course of these last few months goes something like this. Joe Biden comes into office as the candidate who said, I'm going to return us back to a sense of normalcy. And to your point, whatever normal meant to you, a president who acts more like a traditional president, a president who doesn't tweet, who doesn't attack people, a president who's going to tackle the issue right in front of us, which is you got to fix, before you do anything else, fix COVID, economy will come back, here we go. All of that's starting out, and it's going pretty well. I mean, the president, if you look at his approval ratings, February, March, April, especially when we hit April, vaccines are going out. He's putting people on the cabinet that have impressive resumes, have worked in government, right? It was all going to be, might be boring, but it will be stable. It will be consistent. There will be a competency that this previous administration didn't have. Okay. April, May, everybody feels great. CDC says, you don't have to wear masks anymore if you're vaccinated. Wow. June, more people vaccinated. The president, 4th of July, says, we're going to achieve independence from COVID. Okay, fantastic. You see consumer confidence going up. The president's approval ratings are good. And then we get like a 1-2-3 punch in August. Delta, Afghanistan, and the images from the border, right? Where you have Haitian migrants huddled under these bridges and the continuing movement of migrants through Mexico, trying to get across the border. And
I would
that,
add a fourth, and that is the beginnings of inflation,
mm-hmm,
the beginnings, mm-hmm, of higher, mm-hmm, prices.
Absolutely.
That consumers experience.
And that's exactly right. And it's only gotten worse, right, over September, October. And so where you see the president's numbers hit an inflection point really was the end of August. Huh. And it is the challenge for any president, right, which is you're hit with multiple crises, some of your own making, some that you have, there's nothing you could have predicted or done. At the same time, there's a time crunch for this president. They know they've got very narrow majority in the House. All it takes is one senator in the Senate. And if they're going to get anything done with a majority, right, if his presidency is going to have any signature issue that passes, it's got to do it this year. So all these other things are happening, true, have to deal with those. But if you want to put an agenda forward that is not just reactionary, but is looking forward, then you have to do that now. And so he looks then at the same time, right, out of touch. Why are you talking about build back better and building roads when we've got 6% inflation.
So then you have the question of, did Nancy Pelosi make a mistake by not pushing that infrastructure bill earlier while the president's numbers were higher? Get through that and then deal with the more personal, social things. What if?
Right. There are so many what ifs. And then I think too about the vaccine mandates. What if those were put in place at the beginning, right? Which is, we have vaccines that are available to everybody. Oh, also, in order to do XYZ, you need to be vaccinated. Now, I realized there were challenges because the FDA had not approved it, right? So it was still quote unquote experimental. So I appreciate that. But by the time, you know, you finally get FDA approval, mandates go into place. But by then it has already become this very polarized issue. And that becomes even, you know, one more factor to put on the burning pile we just described. For Pelosi, I just feel like she is in a position where she has room to maneuver, but very little of it. I mean, I think back to previous Congresses with narrow majorities, or where a president was trying to get a significant piece of legislation through and through a reconciliation process, and how many votes that president was able to lose from his own party. Look back at Bill Clinton with his budget bill in 93. He had bigger majorities, but he lost 40 Democrats. Even Donald Trump in his tax bill, right? You think, what could be more unifying for the party, a Republican party, than cutting taxes? Even on that, he lost 13 Republicans over the SALT deduction, you know, the taking deduction for state and local taxes. Nancy Pelosi can afford 4 defections. That's it, 4. So everything she does has to be viewed through that lens. And so even being able to get this far, I think, is pretty remarkable on her part. But as you said, you've got, you know, a timetable that, if you were Biden, you would have liked to have seen that pushed up, but he doesn't have that luxury.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Amy Walter. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Amy Walter. She's publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report. Now, with the passage of the infrastructure bill, and we are seeing some movement. This morning, I heard, as you and I are talking on Thursday morning, I heard there is some movement on this social spending bill, because that is what the public is clamoring for. Could that help Joe Biden?
It could help in that it gives him a win. It helps potentially to motivate the Democratic base, right, who has felt somewhat despondent. It's always better to win than to lose, of course. So he can't lose on it, but I don't know that winning is going to provide the sort of impact that many Democrats had hoped. Now, that means in the short term, right? I mean, think about how long it took for Obamacare to become a positive issue for Democrats.
Right.
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 Now, the other thing is, in 2010, in 2012, Democrats never talked about Obamacare. The president ran for re-election. President Obama ran for re-election in 2012, never talking about Obamacare in any of his campaign advertising, which is pretty remarkable, right? Seminal piece of legislation, but don't talk about it because it's still too unpopular. 6 years later, Democrats win back control of the House in part because of Republican attempts to dismantle Obamacare. So these policy positions take quite a long time to get into the American sort of societal bloodstream, right? So the immediate impact of big policy in helping the president's party, there's not many examples of that. But the long term is something different.
That's really an interesting observation. I am also wondering about the governor's race in Virginia and what happened there last month. So many people blame the, quote, woke left for souring voters on Democrats. Your thoughts about that?
So I appreciate the sentiment there, and I do think it played a role in terms of the perceptions of the Democratic Party as being somewhat out of touch with where many voters are. At the same time, it's a chicken or an egg argument, Diane, which is if President Biden were more popular, the public in Virginia would feel less sympathetic to arguments about a woke Democratic Party, right? So they say, things are going well. We feel pretty good about the direction that we're going in, and a Republican coming in and saying, boy, this party is, you know, talking about all these issues that have little bearing on our lives, and we need to put a Republican in office. So, you know, had Biden been more popular, you can argue that these attacks would have had less resonance. The public is much more willing to believe these or to listen to the other side when they feel like the party in power is failing them. Okay. All that said, I do think the challenge for Democrats and specifically for McAuliffe was that I don't think he took seriously enough the idea that parents' concerns about education go beyond this critical race theory or, you know, what's being taught in the schools. And it was much more just a general frustration about how the schools did not react in the ways that they would have liked to have seen. So there was just a deeper frustration to that. Yeah.
That one line of McAuliffe's, parents should stay out of the schools, their children's education. Oh,
and he took a long time to respond. That's the thing. He said it and then was asked about it. And instead of saying, okay, here's what I meant to say, right? I recognize I said that. Let me tell you what I think. He kind of kept doubling down on that. And it was only much later in the campaign where he had to come up and sort of explain himself. But by then it had already taken root. The other thing I think we have to really appreciate is how good a candidate Glenn Youngkin was. And I think many Democrats, perhaps some McAuliffe campaign, had assumed that it was going to be harder for Youngkin to position himself as this just middle of the road Republican than he was able to do. That he would be, you know, trailed by the shadow of Donald Trump, that Trumpism is just so is so cancerous that no Republican can escape it. But
he was smart enough to back away from Trump talk.
Exactly.
And he kept, I mean, I don't think we really know who Youngkin is, and we shall see in the months and weeks to come exactly who he is, because I think his great success was hiding who he was during that campaign, rather than revealing himself in a way that voters already knew McAuliffe. So there you are. We have so many problems that land on Joe Biden's shoulders. I mean, he even got blamed for that because, really, he's getting blamed for a lot of stuff, and it doesn't look good for these 2022 elections.
Right. So as we live in a more nationalized political environment than ever, right, that politics is no longer local, it's much more nationalized. Perceptions of the president, perceptions of Washington matter more than ever. And this is what is so difficult for the party in the White House in every midterm election. It is almost impossible to separate yourself from the president in this day and age. We have very few examples. There are only 16 members of Congress right now, 16 out of 435 who sit in a district that the presidential nominee of their own party didn't win. When I started covering politics in the early 90s, there were like 100 of those districts, right? You had plenty of voters who would say things like, look, I don't like the guy in the White House, but my member, I like her. She's not one of them, right? So you could vote for a Democrat for president and a Republican down ticket or vice versa. That was totally normal. We have fewer senators than ever, really, since the direct election of senators. We have fewer split control states where you have a Democrat or Republican split delegations. We only have 6 of those. So yes, this is it is you've hit on the real challenge now, which is that's a whole lot of power and a whole lot of influence to put on a president who doesn't have as much influence as power as people think he could have, right? As you pointed out, like, well, what could he do about a lot of this stuff? I don't care who you are, Democrat, Republican, you know, superhero. We could put Superman into that office. Couldn't do the things that the public assumes that a president can do. And so it is, and conversely, the president gets credit for a lot of things they'd have no business getting credit for, right? But you, as an individual member of Congress, are at pretty much the whim of that. So your job as a member now is to make sure that your president is popular. That means doing everything you can to keep the base happy, right? Make sure that your team is motivated, and to ensure that he looks strong, he looks decisive, that there's no dissension, right? And then what do you have, right? It's not a very deliberative body, is it?
So tomorrow we'll get job numbers. The last job numbers of the year, depending on how good or how bad they are. The economy, for the most part, is doing well. And people don't seem to care about that. They're saying, well, I have to pay 15 cents more for a loaf of bread. I have to pay 50 cents more for a gallon of milk. So those are the things, even if those job numbers turn out to be good, will that make a difference?
I think it's in people's perceived, I mean, this is why inflation is so dangerous for a president, right? Because there's nothing that hits you more directly when you talk about the economy than, as you just pointed out, I put stuff in my grocery cart that I always put in there. I didn't change anything up, and it's $100 more. I mean, I sit in a lot of these focus groups and I hear that over and over again. It was $100 more. We're not buying meat anymore. You know, I can't believe that I'm spending an extra $20 to fill up my car. And this is real. Now, at the same time, they do say, you know, the good news, my husband and I both have jobs that we feel pretty secure about that. Or, you know, I hear people saying things like, I figured out I could be a pretty good entrepreneur, actually quit my job. You know, I'm making more money now doing this thing that I didn't do before. So I do think the inflation piece is definitely a key. But it's this, as I said, it's this nagging sense that it's the sword of Damocles, right? Like at some point, something is going to go wrong. Another shoe is going to drop. And to me, this was summed up really smartly by a man in a focus group I was listening to about a week ago. And the moderator asked, okay, so tell me things though that you feel hopeful about. And he said, there are just too many unknowns for me to feel hopeful. And so a sense, again, like, so he talked about inflation. He talked about his kids who were young, but should I get them vaccinated? I don't know. I don't know that I trust like little kids getting this. What should I do? People feeling bombarded by misinformation. I hear that a lot too. I don't know what to believe. I keep hearing all these different stories. My parents are saying this thing to me and I have to talk to them about that. On Facebook, I have friends saying this thing. I listen to the news. It's telling me this thing. What do I believe? What should I do? So again, that is not something that a president can come in like, boop, fix it. But it is just, I think we have to be realistic, and we weren't, I don't think, that a pandemic is not something you bounce out of. It is a long slog. But I think the president and many others did have a sense, and he talked about this with transitory inflation, right? That this was just a short-term thing.
Yeah.
We shut the country down, but we can open it back up. It's great. Look it, we got vaccines. We're going to get back to normal. Well, guess what? There is not an easy back to normal. And that, I think, is the president suffering from that reality right now.
So back to job numbers, What do you expect?
I don't know. I haven't really looked at that, in part because I don't know that that is where consumers are spending their attention right now. I think we were really concerned about that, let's say in 2009 and 10, as people were saying, I don't know where I'm going to get a job. Now, the issue is, and again, I heard this from a voter the other night, yeah, I'm getting paid a little bit more, or I'm getting paid the same salary, but it's getting eaten up by inflation, right?
Inflation.
So that their worry is less, do I have a job? And much more, is this job going to provide enough? And that's where you also see the real push in so many places from workers, right? Saying, well, wait a minute, I now have leverage. You need me more than I need you.
Absolutely.
So guess what? You're going to pay me $15 an hour, or I'm going to get X, Y, and Z when it comes to healthcare or paid leave or whatever. So employers now having to respond much more to a tighter labor market than workers worrying about getting the job. Now it is a job that also provides more of more the benefits that they're looking for.
So final question, who do the Democrats need to go after the most, the independent voters or the so-called surge voters?
Right.
And you might explain the surge voters.
So as we know, in 2018 and 2020, we had record number of people turn out to vote. Literally 100-year records. And we know that so much of that surge was driven really by one person, and that was Donald Trump. Surge of people who liked him, surge of people who truly disliked him. And for Democrats, that surge, those new voters who came in, proved to be critical, especially at the presidential level. The question is, how do you continue to keep them motivated, get them to turn out to vote? We hear a lot, especially about younger voters and voters of color. And the challenge there, this is, again, where the president seems to be getting hit by all sides. You have one group of voters saying he's not doing enough on returning to normal, the normal that I want to see. You have younger voters saying, you know, we marched in the streets in 2020 for racial justice, and I don't see this administration doing enough on that, right? Where is the voting rights bill? Where's police reform? Where, you know, we said Donald Trump isn't doing right by us. And yet, I don't think politicians, they kind of sold us a bill of goods. Right? Now, Democrats come back and say, well, we have this filibuster thing and you can't. That is not particularly motivating, right? To say to people, keep voting for us. We can't really change it because the system doesn't allow it, but eventually we'll figure it out. So that is the challenge with those voters. With independent voters, it is, again, it's getting back to this place where they feel a confidence that the president and Democrats are handling, are tackling the concerns that are most pressing to them. And so you have to have both of those things. You know, you can't afford to be doing poorly with both of those groups. And in that sense, where the president needs to get is, you know, something to keep those voters, those surge voters, those people turned out as, I don't want to say that they're all just anti-Trump, but that was obviously a motivating factor, right? Was less about, I'm excited for Joe Biden than it was, we really got to get rid of this Donald Trump character. How do you keep them motivated with Donald Trump out of the picture? And without being able to deliver on some of those things that they really wanted to see? And then for independents, that is, okay, Diane, by the time we get to next spring or summer, is inflation back to a reasonable place? Are people feeling a little more confidence in what they're seeing coming out of the White House? That, I think, is where the president needs to be, and that we're not seeing the infighting among Democrats, right, about Build Back Better and infrastructure. Instead, it's full steam ahead, focusing on all the positives, dealing with the inevitable fires that are going to come up, but returning America, or returning for many Americans, a feeling that America's kind of back on track. We've been knocked off kilter, and now we're back. And that alone is, I think, motivating for many voters.
Amy Walter, thank you for being with us.
I loved it. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you. That was Amy Walter, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.